episode 77, the Almost Dr. David Geyer Show, recorded April 18th, 2014. Now, if you listen to the Dr. David Geyer Show, then you would, you know, be missing all the cool sound effects and the intro right there and the sports whistles and all that stuff. But, you know, this is the Almost Dr. David Geyer Show, so we almost have, you know, the same stuff. But we do have Dr. David Geyer on our show today, so he's joining us, taking a break from surgery. And if you're watching live, you can use the hashtag TheSMB on Twitter, or you can type your comments in the question and answer section, and then hopefully Morena will see those. George will see them on Twitter. You can check out sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, watch live there, and do some of those questions there. I am, of course, your host, Jeremy Jackson, and with me today is...
George.
Marlon.
Peter.
Morena.
Jocelyn.
Marissa.
Morena.
And, of course, Dr. David Geyer. If you want to check out Dr. Geyer's website, it is drdavidgeyer.com. It's a really cool website, very useful. I was just browsing around. He's got some resources, some books or ebooks that he's been a part of in the podcast, which he's on like episode 139 or something like that. So he does that each week. So you can check that out at drdavidgeyer.com, and we'll talk more about that as we go through this. So without much further ado...
Dr. Geyer, can you tell us who you are and what you do?
Absolutely. So I am an orthopedic surgeon. After my med school, I went and did orthopedic surgery training, so surgery and treatment of injuries of the bones and joints mainly. So on top of just being a general orthopedic surgeon, I did a sports medicine fellowship. I did an extra year of training in orthopedic sports medicine. So that is a lot of work with athletes, and it's also a lot of work doing arthroscopic surgeries. Almost all the surgeries I do are through the scope, shoulder surgeries and knee surgeries especially. So probably 80% or so of my practice is not just athletes, but athletic people with injuries, musculoskeletal injuries, and then the ones that need surgery, I do their arthroscopic surgeries.
All right, so is that athletes of all different ages?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point, because I think a lot of people tend to not consider themselves athletes. So, yes, there's pro athletes, high school, college athletes for sure, but a much larger part of my patient population are people that play rec league sports, you know, either youth sports or adults, you know, playing rec league soccer or something like that, or people that just like to run or like to lift weights. So anybody that's trying to get in shape or trying to do something fitness or exercise related and, you know, hurts their shoulder or twists their knee or something like that, that's where I come in and hopefully get them back to that.
Can you talk about, like, your relationship with the athletic trainers?
Yeah, so, and I probably should have said this in the intro, my first 8 years I was the director of the sports medicine program at the academic hospital here in Charleston, the medical university. I just left there to start a sports medicine program in a private hospital, but and that literally was within the last few months, so I'm not currently working with athletic trainers, but in those 8 years that I was at the medical university, we had athletic trainers in our sports medicine program, some full-time, some part-time, that would help with the team coverage. That was the main role we used athletic trainers, but we also had them work with injury prevention programs at the high school level and then with the pro teams that we took care of. Plus, they covered a lot in the community, soccer tournaments, lacrosse, rugby tournaments. We were starting to incorporate them into clinics, but just due to how much – you know, basically we covered in terms of sporting events, they were mainly out in the community and with the teams.
So obviously a lot of orthopedic surgeons work closely, you know, work with athletic trainers because we send a lot of athletes to them and, you know, we have to have them cleared and that kind of thing. But you think that running that sports medicine, say it again, was it a sports medicine?
Yeah, it was university? A program. Yeah, we had – well, I was at the medical university here in Charleston. And so we had obviously orthopedic surgeons and primary care doctors, but we had neurologists, physical therapists, athletic trainers. We had a sports nutritionist, sports psychologist. So it was a comprehensive program for really any kind of need that an injured athlete would have. The athletic trainers were a huge part of that on the initial evaluation and treatment side is where they were mostly used with us. They were the front lines of evaluating injuries at the teams and the schools that they worked with, and then deciding if they needed to be referred on. But then they were also involved on the back side after they were evaluated, you know, treated surgically or not. There's a lot of role, as you guys know, in you know, being involved, you know, doing some of the rehab, but also being involved in the communication, making sure everybody's on the same page in terms of return to play, making sure that the athletes are actually doing what they're supposed to, or more importantly, not doing what they're not supposed to. So they were key components for sure.
Can you tell us more about how sitting shortens your life?
Sure. You know, that was a surprise to me. I actually just wrote about this, maybe 2 weeks ago. There has been increasing talk that no matter how, you know, a lot of us, I guess, let me set it up, a lot of us have jobs or hobbies or just, you know, it's our nature to sit a lot. You know, you may work a desk job, you may have a fairly active job, but then you spend a lot of time doing notes in clinic or whatever it is where you're sitting a lot, or you may just like to watch a lot of TV. And so we know that that's obviously not physical activity and it's not good for you. And the assumption was that, well, you could go exercise at the end of the day and kind of make up for that. But what we're starting to see, some very recent research, is that that exercise may not help. And the longer you sit, even if you exercise, if you're sitting, you know, 6, 7, 8 hours a day at your job, or coming home and watching TV for 4 or 5 hours, that can shorten your life. Where it seems to manifest most is as you get older, you start becoming more disabled. You end up needing crutches, or not so much crutch, but a cane or a walker, or you have difficulty going up and down stairs or just getting around without assistance. And we know those then turn to shortening your life. I think as research goes on, we're going to find it also has damaging effects in terms of body weight, maintenance of blood pressure, maintenance of cholesterol, things like that. So the message then to take home is if you do have to sit a lot, because a lot of people have to do that for their job, get up periodically and move around, find ways to get exercise even a little bit, or physical activity even a little bit, even at work, and turn off the TV and do more engaging physical activities when you get home.
What are your thoughts on wobble or balance ball chairs?
So I think that I would put that in the same category. That's like an example of what we were just talking about. I think that when you, if you're at a desk job, have to, you know, sit staring at a computer for 4, 5, 6 hours at a time, you know, all day at work, you know, any way you can get some sort of physical activity is good. The wobble balls, the stability balls, let you work on core stability. And be doing something physically active while you're staring and typing away at that computer. You know, obviously there's the even better ideas than that. Things like treadmill desks and are kind of the latest rage, especially down here in Charleston. Stand-up desks are a pretty good alternative as well. But, you know, even if it's just getting rid of your normal flat chair and getting a stability ball that you sit on all day, every little bit counts.
So you're saying that that would be pretty good idea, because I mean, I know that I think the article said when after age 25, but you know, here at the school it's kind of set up for them to sit. You know, they'll walk to class and then they sit, and then they walk to class and then they sit, so they sit for 45 minutes out of every hour. And so something I was thinking about doing was getting like the balance balls or the wobble chairs, and you know, gives them a little bit more active time during the day. So
yeah, I think any little bit helps. And you know, a lot of people, and I'm a good example of this too. You know, I like to lift weights and do some cardio. It's not as, I don't like that quite as much, but I do very little core work. It's a bad habit. I just don't. So, you know, if that's a pretty simple way to get it, and it doesn't hurt, it's not hard, but it's still serving a purpose. And so I think it's a good alternative. It's certainly better than not doing it, I think.
Can you talk about your journey of becoming a surgeon?
Sure. Yeah, I don't know that there's a right way to do it. I think I kind of did probably the most traditional. So I went after college, went straight to medical school. I didn't take any time off. I didn't know at the time that I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon, but I was pretty confident I wanted to be some sort of surgeon. The nature of my personality, I like to deal with one problem and fix it and kind of move on. I don't like to just kind of manage different problems for years and years, like what family doctors and internal medicine doctors tend to do, which is great. It's just not my personality. I like to fix things. So I knew I wanted to be some kind of surgeon. And so once you start rotating in the different fields, I really liked orthopedics. And it's been great. You know, basically you get people back to doing what they like to do. And that, to a lesser extent, that's why I really liked sports medicine, is because these people like to exercise. They like to work out. And so you fix the one issue that they have, and very frequently that you get them back to what they like to do. It's been a long process for sure. You know, 4 years of medical school, 5 years of residency, and 1 year of sports medicine is a long road, but I think it's worth it.
What's your favorite part of being a surgeon?
Let's see. I don't know that that's an easy answer. I think my answer might be surprising. It's probably not the surgery point part at all, really. Don't get me wrong. I like, you know, doing ACLs and doing shoulder instability surgeries through the scope. But I think the best part of sports medicine, especially on the orthopedic surgeon side, is just being able to clear sports, clear people for exercise, and seeing the excitement on their face when you tell them they can go back to play. You know, they may have been out for 6 weeks or 6 months, but again, that's what they really like to do. And so that side of it is probably my favorite, being in the clinic, getting them back out there once they've recovered from their injury.
What's your least favorite part about it?
I don't know. That's probably, it depends on the day, honestly. If you can't go on Twitter and follow many physicians for very long without hearing about the issues in healthcare, there's just so much paperwork. There's so much drive for numbers. You know, it's not even the volume. I mean, I see a lot of patients normally anyway. I don't mind that. But there's more and more pressure from the hospitals, more and more pressure from basically managers, business managers of hospitals and practices, pushing, you know, people to see more patients, which obviously means shorter visits. There's more paperwork, there's more documentation. That part is getting less and less fun. The burnout rate is growing pretty quickly. And I do worry, it's probably a bigger discussion than we have time for here, but I do worry a little bit about the future of medicine with all of those challenges. That part of it, unfortunately, is just not fun. The patient care is great, but that, to be fair, is only 60, maybe 65, at best, 70% of medicine anymore.
All right, so on that same note, you're talking about burnout, because, you know, when I talk to students here, we're teaching sports medicine, so they're interested in medicine, and a lot of them want to be doctors. But when you talk to doctors, like you said, there's a lot of patient load, there's a lot of paperwork, there's a lot of this other stuff. Can you talk a little bit more directly at this point to students who are desiring or intending to be doctors about the realities of your job?
Absolutely. And I think it's important to say that that doesn't mean it's still not a great job. I mean, any chance you get to make a difference in somebody's health and in somebody's life, that's always a good thing. And so if you're doing it for that reason or whatever your personal reasons are for wanting to be a doctor, I'm all for that. I would strongly encourage anybody that's doing it because they think that it's an easy lifestyle or you're going to make a lot of money. I think that's where I'd be careful to think through it really well. I mean, it's not that you can't do well. I mean, you're not going to make nearly as much money as they made 10 and 20 years ago. The doctors, the insurance companies, and everything else have cut way down on that. But with all of the other issues involved, the paperwork, the insurance demands, the depositions you end up doing if you see workers' comp patients, I mean, there's just so much to it that will burn you out if it's only money that got you involved. You need to be making sure you're doing it for the right reasons. I saw a study, I want to say it was within the last week or so, that 9 out of 10 physicians right now would not recommend to other people to go into medicine. That has to tell you something, that there's a problem. So I'm not to that point. I would recommend people do it if they're doing it for the right reasons and not just because it's something they'll get paid really well for.
It's one of the get to know you type questions we ask sometimes, is would you rather work really hard at an interesting job or or slack off at a boring job or something like that. And, you know, most of them said they would rather work really hard at an interesting job. And so I think that's kind of what you're talking about there, huh?
Yeah, you just need to really know why you want to do it. And I think that's where athletic trainers and physicians are fortunately alike in a lot of ways, in that we're trying to help people. You guys are much more specific to athletes, at least at the team and the schools, but you're trying to get players back in the game. You're trying to help them prevent injuries. You're evaluating injuries. And physicians, albeit they may not be sports medicine, taking care of athletes, they're trying to do the same thing. They're trying to help people get back to what they enjoy doing. And if you do it for those reasons, I think healthcare is great. Again, I think that and then you're right, that's probably true with any profession. I mean, if you do it, whatever it is, I mean, look at the lawyers. Every lawyer I know is pretty unhappy, even though they do relatively well, but they work really hard, and most of them that I know at least don't enjoy it. So if you go into medicine, you go into athletic training because you want to help people and you really enjoy what you do, I think you're going to be happy regardless of the money and everything else.
All right, so to sum that up, if you're doing it because you think you're going to make a lot of money, then it's completely the wrong reason. You're going to probably fail.
You'll probably you may make a lot of money, but you'll really deal with a lot of frustration.
All right. Now, I know you do a lot of other stuff, as I was reading on your website, which is, again, drdavidgeyer.com, that you're the lead orthopedic or lead doctor for the large tennis tournament, the professional soccer league team, or professional league soccer, something like that, the soccer team there in Charleston, and a couple of other things. How much time does that stuff take? And I have a kind of a quick question. Married and have kids, or?
I am not married. I have two kids from a previous marriage, but no, I'm not married currently. As far as the team coverage, that was mainly through when I was at the medical or the program director of the sports medicine program at the medical university. I will be doing a lot more of that here, but the tennis tournament and the soccer team was through them. And it really depends on the sport how much time that takes. I mean, the professional soccer, you had to be there at every game and before and after games, and so it took a decent amount of time outside of clinic, outside of surgery. A lot of the things you take care of, you don't physically have to be there as often, and so it really depends. I really liked that side of it, so I may have spent more time than others, but you know, there's all different ways to do it. And that's another one, and you didn't really ask, but now that I'm thinking about it, you were talking about, you know, why people, you know, go into certain fields. I think there's this big rush to take care of the pro teams and things like that, and I think that's great. But that's another one. You better really enjoy that because you're going to put a lot of time into it. And I don't know that there's that much appeal anymore into going to the doctor of this pro team or that pro team. And so I don't know that I would recommend to other sports medicine surgeons and physicians or anybody else, you know, to work with the pro teams or the college teams unless you really like it. Because I don't know that the payback is going to be there unless you get the satisfaction out of it. It's a lot of time, especially at the professional level. You guys, I'm preaching to the choir. I mean, look at the hours you guys put in. And you just have to make sure that, again, that you really like that kind of thing. I did, so it wasn't a big deal.
Yeah, I definitely feel that, you know, this job as an athletic trainer is pretty tough, but I'm pretty good. You know, I work pretty well with our orthopedic surgeon, Dr. David Crumby, and whenever I go to see surgeries or I go to the Saturday injury clinic, you know, I've asked him a couple times, you know, do you ever go home? Do you ever see your family? Because he's got a wife and I think three kids, and, you know, it's just, I'm like, man, you need to go home and hang out with them because he's always there. You know, I think he does the stuff for the Rockets and for U of H, which is the University of Houston, and he's like part-time with the Texans, and it's ridiculous how much stuff you can easily get yourself into. So,
yeah. It's just you make sacrifices sometimes, and if you really enjoy doing it, it's worth it. But yeah, the pro teams and the college teams, because, you know, not just the games, it's the travel with the teams a lot of times. It's the being able to work somebody into your office right then and there, not just, you know, when it's convenient for you. It can be challenging. So if you do it again for the notoriety, you know, I would argue that it may not be worth it. If you're doing it because, hey, you really like getting athletes at that level, and again, those are the best athletes in the world, then I think it's great.
Why did you start a podcast?
Oh, I don't know. And depending on the week, you know, I kind of ask myself that same thing. You know, I had done the blog for about a year before I started the podcast, and I was really getting a lot of good feedback. I was really surprised, honestly, how many people would read the articles I was writing. But I always felt like that there was a different medium that I could do what I do. You know, I like to do radio interviews and talk about injured athletes. I like to answer questions about people's individual injuries and getting back to sports. And I like to, you know, kind of analyze topics in sports injuries and sports medicine. And so those obviously are the three big components of my podcast. But I thought it would be kind of a different medium and get a different audience. And I don't know kind of how, what you guys have noticed, but that's exactly what's happened. I've got a very different audience as far as the podcast goes, much probably more engaged audience, quite honestly, than the readers I get on the blog. And it's just been really good. It's exposed me to new people and new ways of communicating. I probably, this may be a bad example today, but I feel like it's helped me communicate a little bit better, helped me speak in front of the microphone better. So I've really enjoyed it. It's a lot of work, as I know you guys have figured out. I mean, for each of my shows are an hour. I probably put about 5.5 to 6 hours a week, and it used to be longer than that. I've just streamlined it. But it's about 6 hours of work to create a one-hour podcast. And so I'm not sure if I didn't really enjoy it that I would do it. You know, if you wanted to, I suppose you could sell ads and make a lot of money and that kind of thing. But I don't think that that's really why you do any of this blogging, podcast, any of this. Like you guys, I think it's about getting information out there, spreading a message, spreading information that helps people in their sports or in their exercise and in their lives. And so in that sense, the podcast has been great.
All right, so I want to go back to your show a little bit. Do you produce all that yourself? Because, you know, you have a lot of like intro or in between music, yeah. And you know, it's really clean. And so you said, you know, you streamlined a lot, but is that something you do all that yourself?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I do. I took a course ages ago on podcasting, which I would highly recommend, that helped with all that. And then I hired somebody to create the intro music and the outro music, and then just got some generic bumpers, some filler music that sounded sports medicine related. But I've got a program that basically it's all you click buttons while you're talking and the music starts and that kind of thing. But it took me a while to get good at doing it. So, I mean, it's easy to talk in front of a mic and hit buttons, but then you have to go back and you know, splice parts out. And you know, I don't record it straight through like you guys do. I record it basically in four big segments and then put it all together. I do all that myself. I had help early with some, you know, some of it, and I have help on the research of the topic side, but the production I do. Anybody looking to do a podcast, I'll tell you that think through that part of it real well, because there's a decent amount of work, and there are people out there that will produce them. In retrospect, I might have done that, where all you're doing is creating the content, and they can actually make it sound really good. But I was determined to do it myself, and yeah, so that's what happened.
Yeah, I spend a good bit of time. I mean, you know, I'm here, I'm teaching class, and so typically our schedule is we'll do the podcast on Wednesdays, and so on Tuesday we'll spend about half of the period going over the questions and getting the equipment set up and checking to make sure everything's working, and then Wednesday we'll do the show, and then I'll spend, you know, Thursday and Friday editing and posting and doing all this other stuff, because I can't have them doing all that stuff, because we have to also have to learn sports medicine. You know, currently we're going over the knee, so we have to talk about that stuff, and it's a lot, like you said, a lot of work to do all that. So on that same note, how do you I know you said it's because something that you really enjoy doing, you really love it, but how do you manage that?
Yeah. like in terms of fitting the schedule in and when do I do it, that kind of thing.
Right. So more, I guess,
okay.
Correctly, do you sleep?
Oh, yeah. No, actually, I had to kind of start over the last 2 years or so, start getting more sleep. I started when I started the blog and podcast. I did it late at night and, you know, whenever I could, and I wasn't sleeping much at all, and that was a recipe for failure. I mean, I was really, really struggling. So I committed to more sleep, and I got good at carving time out in the day. So, like, for instance, every week I'll talk about four or five athletes and their injuries. And, you know, I noticed that I was always reading, you know, ESPN and Yahoo Sports and things like that anyway for a few minutes every day just to see what was going on. And so I would basically see the injuries. I would clip the article about the different players out in Evernote. Then there'd be a file that I would go through when I went to create the show, and I'd just basically make my outline out of that. Like I said, I have somebody that helps with the research of my main segment, the In the Zone segment. This week, like, I'm talking about lacrosse injuries. And so I got somebody to send me about 10 articles on lacrosse, and I'll go through that in the next day or two and cut it down to what I'm going to talk about. And I kind of piece that in, but I like to have, you know, basically the outline of the show ready to go by Friday so that I can record it sometime, usually Friday, but sometime Saturday or Sunday. I don't do much at all in the way of editing anymore. I used to do it really heavily, every and all that kind of stuff, and I don't do that much anymore. When it's recorded, I just have to add a couple of segments of music and upload it, and it's done. And I just had to because it was taking way too long once I did that. So that helps some. But, yeah, it's a process. If you really like doing it again, you find a way to fit it in your schedule.
So on that same note, you have said you have people send in your articles. Is there a way that possibly I could have my students help you in that? I mean, I know you have probably athletic trainers or even doctors sending you articles or things that may be interested. Is there something that, you know, maybe a part of our weekly assignment is they can find something that they really want to talk about and, you know, send you one question or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, probably the easiest way to do that would, and there's, like, again, you can send URLs, you know, of stories. And I get friends of mine that do that too, that they'll see an injury, like somebody alerted me to Ian Thorpe's shoulder infection. You know, I never saw that, but apparently he's really, really sick with this shoulder infection after surgery. Somebody sent that to me. I think it was on Twitter, just with a URL. So you can absolutely send those through Twitter, or there's the email address through my blog, and I check that about every third day or so, and certainly check it a day or two before I record. Absolutely. I'm always looking for ideas because I like to know what people want to talk about. I mean, if I pick the topics routinely, I'm going to stick to things that I really like. But, you know, if people are really interested in hockey injuries, I'm not a huge hockey fan, but, you know, alert me to hockey injuries and I'm happy to talk about them. So, or it could be anything. So, yeah, Twitter or the contacts section on my blog are probably the two ways to get those to me. And I'm happy to do it anytime. I mean, for instance, somebody just last week asked me, you know, what he was a first-year medical student and wanted to know, you know, what my advice would be to making sure he had a good shot at getting an orthopedic surgery residency. So, you know, if your students have questions along those lines, or it's athletes of the teams that they watch, definitely send those to me. I'm always, always looking for people to give them what they want to hear.
All right, so it'd be pretty cool for them to, you know, take some of the stuff they're learning or some of the stuff they're seeing, and then possibly have that on a show that
I'll mention them too, because I like to, you know, credit people who you know, did, you know, got the information to me or alerted me to it. So yeah, definitely happy to do that if they're interested.
And I will say, I just finished listening to someone yesterday, and right there at the end, I know it's like the trash talkers or fan favorites, is he does exactly that. He says, you know, so-and-so from Ohio said this, or so-and-so on Twitter said this, that kind of thing. So if it's something that you see that you're interested in, you'd like them to talk about, we'll send it. We'll work on maybe doing that, sending you one thing a week or something. No promises, but...
Oh, no worries. Or even if it's just that they, you know, have thoughts on something I, you know, say on a show segment. If I'm answering a show or a question about, You know, I think the one that comes to mind from last week was the scaphoid non-union, which is basically a fracture of the bone in the wrist, and it hadn't healed. And somebody asked me about PRP, and I've gotten a number of comments saying, hey, maybe I should try that. You know, just reply to my mention of it on Twitter, and I can certainly – I'd love to hear what people think about anything I talk about, and I'll certainly I'll mention it and use it on the show. It may not be the next show, but as soon as I can get it on, I'll use it.
Very cool. Yeah. Right, so on to a little bit of actual sports medicine stuff. I work some volleyball tournaments, the club volleyball, and so those have like 11 to 18-year-old kids. Yeah. And so, you know, one of the things that when I was talking to Dr. Crumby is if a, you know, a young kid in the, you know, 11 to 13 age-ish has an injury somewhere around a growth plate, you really want to suspect a growth plate fracture because those have to be fixed within like 2 or 3 days to heal properly. It's kind of what I remember him saying. But I hadn't asked him, how can I really test for those growth plate fractures?
Yeah, I don't know that there's any one test that will tell you that there's a good chance of a growth plate fracture. I think he's right that, you know, if there's a question that it's a fracture, you're going to want to look into it sooner rather than later, because if it's not lined up well, potentially it needs surgery. I guess the simple way, and you probably know this, but for anybody watching or listening, the first part of it is, I would say, you know, based on the patient or the athlete's age, that plays a role. So it's a little simplistic, but structures fail at the point of least resistance. So older high school kids and obviously adults are going to basically tear their tendons and ligaments because the bones are really strong. But in kids that haven't gone through puberty, it's going to fail at the bones more often than at the tendons and ligaments. So fractures are much more common, say 14 and younger. And if it's going to be a fracture, very often the weak link is at the growth plate, the physis. So the first thing I would say is, if the young athlete hurts, you just push on them and it's right on bone as opposed to in the joint space, I worry that there's a fracture there. And so I treat it more aggressively, you know, get x-rays. And sometimes, depending on what body part it is, put them in a splint or in a cast rather than, say, just a removable device. But other than that, I think it really depends on the specific body part, but bony tenderness at the joint instead of along the ligaments would probably be what I'd look for the most.
All right, so then if I am at this volleyball tournament, then, you know, these people, there's people from Canada and from Mexico, yeah, and all these other places at some of these volleyball tournaments. And so the parents bring the kid over, and should I say, you know, I feel like there's a fracture, should I send them, since they're in Houston and they live out of state, to the ER to get an x-ray, or should I say, hey, as soon as you get back, you need to make an appointment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's a couple sides to that, and there's probably each case would be different. I think the first thing would be if they can't put any weight on it, if it's in the foot or the ankle or the knee, or they can't use their arm because it hurts so bad at, you know, wrist, elbow, something like that, I think you can never err by being too aggressive and going to the ER. Yeah, they may have to sit there for a while and they may have a higher cost, but there's much less risk going that way. If it is something that hurts, but it's not so swollen, it's not so incapacitating that they're just miserable and they can potentially get around, then, and you don't see any obvious displacement, you know, the elbow is straight or is not crooked, the leg, you know, that kind of thing, then I think it's probably okay to let them go back home and get an x-ray as soon as they get home. And you just tell them, hey, look, if you're really hurting over the next few hours, you know, call me, I'll help you get into an ER right away, something like that. I wish there was a more specific answer to give you than that, but I think it really is unfortunately a case-by-case decision.
Yeah, I definitely understand it. You know, these are people that are at a tournament, so they don't even really know my name. They, you know, I don't interact with them, and so
And you'll never see them again, and so, you know, my experience, and I'm kind of curious what yours is, my experience with that is more often than not, they would rather just see if they can deal with it when they get back. It's hard to talk them into going to the ER unless it's obvious that something really bad is going on. So, you know, assuming that it doesn't look worrisome, I'm usually okay with that.
Yeah, you know, like you said, most of the time they want to deal with it later. They don't want to have to go to the ER in a different city, but sometimes the people that the people that are at these club volleyball tournaments, you know, that's their whole life. So
sure.
So they're like, oh, we have to take care of this right now. We have to go to the ER so that we know if she can play tomorrow. Yeah. Well, she can't walk right now. She's probably not playing tomorrow.
Exactly. But, yeah, I see that a lot. Like, I mean, they're convinced that a few Advil and she'll be fine. And it makes no sense. Like, how is she going to jump on this? So, no, I completely agree with you. You've got challenges on both sides, that they want to go back home and not deal with it at all, or they want the full court press workup so that, you know, they know it's not doing any harm to play on it.
Yep. So I had a new one when I was working a tournament a couple weekends ago, and it was really cool because I was able to take two of my students, and they worked the whole tournament with me, so they get to see a lot of different injuries and stuff like that. But one girl, she was about 12 years old, and her mom said she had been to the doctor and been diagnosed with chronic IT band syndrome.
Huh.
I'd never heard of that before. But then at the same time, what's that doing to a 12-year-old if she continues to play with this? And, you know, is it something she should take some time off and then rest and stretch and then just not play volleyball for a season? Or what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I've seen it very often in that young of an athlete, honestly. Almost everybody I've seen it is an adult, and not even high school and college age. I mean, they're, you know, 20s, 30s. You know, I think generally anytime a 12-year-old athlete has some sort of problem that's not related to an acute event, you know, tripped and fell or got tackled or something like that, like, rest is always an option, or at least backing them off of whatever hurts. The thing about IT band issues is, my experience, at least with the adults, is that even a short period of rest, a lot of times it'll come back as soon as they go back. And so I'm there a pretty big advocate of, if they can work with a physical therapist a lot, that's certainly a good thing, or at least work with somebody once or twice, or an athletic trainer if they have time to do it, to learn some exercises, the proper ways to do those exercises to treat it, and then do those every day. 12 years old, the reason I like therapy on top of all that, though, is that it's hard to motivate them to do daily exercises. So going to physical therapy two or three times a week sometimes will ensure that they do what they need to do to get over it. But I'm with you. That's an unusual one. I can't say that I've seen that very often.
All right. So I wanted to ask you something else about the chairs. And I meant to reread the article, but I couldn't find it. We were talking about sitting. So, like, a lot of times when I get home from work, I'll go in, I'll be on laying on the floor in the living room. And then I know it said something about non-sleeping hours. So does the main point of the article was just activity, right? So if I'm laying on the floor wrestling with my 4-year-old boy, is that counting as activity for me? Or, you know, do I really need to be up and, you know, chasing around the backyard?
No, I mean, I think that's okay. It's not that I think anybody is saying, hey, look, you can't sit ever. I think the concern is people that are sitting for hours on end and not getting up and moving. And so, no, I wouldn't stop doing that on your side. But, you know, I would try to every so often get up, move around. I mean, it can be as simple as, like, if you have a desk job, you know, put a kettlebell next to your desk, and every 30 minutes, 45 minutes, get up and do, you know, 10 or 15 kettlebell swings or something like that. I mean, just anything to get some sort of physical activity and get moving, you know, standing squats or wall squats. I mean, anything like that. Walk to your meetings, and, you know, or walk instead of sending emails, walk across the building to talk to somebody. Whatever you have to do to get up moving, I think is a good thing. And then when you're at home, resist the temptation to watch TV for 4 straight hours. I think that's probably the bigger and the easier one to fix, is that you just, you know, do things that are active as much as possible. But no, I don't know that any one activity where you're laying down is necessarily harmful.
And then in your post, you had mentioned that you were going to be working on that, you know, like you'd said, the treadmill desk, something like that.
Yeah.
How do you feel that you've been doing since then?
Yeah, not as well as I should. I've actually got one of those fitness bracelets and it vibrates every 30 minutes that I've been sitting still, and it still goes off several times a day. So I'm not as good about it. But it's helped my overall every day. My number of steps have gotten better since I started watching it and things like that. But, you know, when you go to, I mean, you guys know this from doing the podcast, and it's no different writing blog posts and newspaper columns. I mean, it's hard to not have periods where you're not sitting for 60 or 90 straight minutes. And in my case, that's sometimes several times a day. And so I just need to get better about it.
So you talked about that bracelet too, and I've looked into those a couple of times. There's two things. One, I'm really interested in getting one, but another reason I am is I wonder if it would work the opposite of how it's designed to. Like, because with our concussion kids, we want them to basically not be doing anything. We want them to be not active and, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm wondering if there's a way to use that technology to kind of monitor how little they're doing. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm sure that it can be measured. I don't know the programming side of it, but I'm sure mine, I don't know that I could reverse it and make it go off when I've been active, even though it has a stopwatch type of feature on it. So I'm sure that something like that could be done. I think all of that's coming in future generations. I'm not a huge technology expert by any means, but I think we're not far away from where basically all kinds of health data, health metrics of everything you do are going to be tracked. I mean, the rumors are in this Apple iWatch, not only is it going to be able to measure your blood oxygen levels and your heart rate and things like that, but it potentially could measure your blood sugars. I mean, I think we're not that far. In the case of concussions, I wouldn't think it would be that difficult to create something that basically reminds them, hey, look, you know, you're not supposed to be doing anything, and you've been walking way more than we want you to, something like that. I don't think that we're that far off, actually. And that sounds scary, honestly, but I think there's potential huge upside to getting people more knowledgeable about all aspects of their health.
And you've been really pleased with it's the Up 24 that you have, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I've been pleased with it. The I think they, and by no means am I think there may be others out there that are just as good or better. I just like this one because it's comfortable and doesn't look awful, doesn't look like a bracelet as much as some of the others do. But, I've been pleased with it. It's good sleeping. It wakes you up in the light phases of your sleep, so I like it. It measures your steps. The only thing that probably annoys me about it, if there's anything, is that if you do exercise that's not basically walking or running, you have to enter that manually because it doesn't give you credit for that. But otherwise, no, I like it a lot. More than I thought I would, at least.
And then so one thing I was wondering, because it says it syncs via Bluetooth.
Yeah.
Do you have to keep your phone on? Because I'll turn my phone off, I'll leave it in the living room, and then, you know, when I go to bed. So does that ever cause a problem when you turn your phone off?
No, I mean, because once you turn it back on, then it'll download the whole day's worth of data. It doesn't disappear. And in fact, you could probably make a pretty good case to do that, because otherwise it's constantly syncing, and one of the reasons it might drain your phone battery. But that's not a problem at all. As soon as you open the app, if it hasn't synced in a while, it syncs it all then. So, I'm a big fan of it. I know some people that have various Up bracelets that haven't been as pleased, but the 24 I've really liked.
Very cool. I'm definitely going to look into those, and I'm going to probably continue talking to our concussion specialist about the potentials of stuff that we just talked about, getting those things to figure out if there's a way we can keep them from being active, or, you know, just at least remind them. And so,
yeah, I've got to think it's possible. I'm not the programming side, like I said, but I cannot imagine it would be all that difficult. The other side would be, you know, one of the things that's always kind of on the horizon, but the use of text messages in healthcare. Even if it's just an automated program that sends texts every couple, 2-3 hours, you know, kind of giving them a new tip so you don't feel like they don't feel like you're nagging them, but a tip of what to expect, what to do, what not to do in concussions, that's easy enough to do. There's software out there that will send those. You just schedule them. They're basically like the old school slide projectors. You load, you know, 50 or 60 or 100 text messages in there, and basically tell it to send every few hours between the hours of you know, X and Y. That's relatively easy to do. I don't know that it's as good as one that monitors what they do and then gives them feedback accordingly, but might be a simpler solution.
Yeah, we have something like that in education called Remind 101 where teachers can do that for free. So, like, I can text message my whole class, but yeah, it does similar to what you're saying. So if there's any teachers happen to be listening, if you have a school district email, you can use Remind 101 and you can do a mass group text to, you know, a couple hundred people or something. But and then maybe you could help remind them not to do activity. So, okay, well, that is all the questions we have, and that's just about time for them to go to lunch. Dr. Geyer, do you have any other thoughts before we
I just want to say, I guess, as I like to do, I imagine it's a lot of athletic trainers watching this, and I think speaking for a lot of orthopedic surgeons, I think I can't say enough how appreciative we are for all the hours you guys put in on the fields, in the training rooms, behind the scenes that so many people don't see. I can't say enough how much everybody appreciates it, and I can tell you that the athletes do. As we were talking before the show off the air, you guys tend to have just fantastic relationships with athletes, and I think that that is a testament to how hard you work and how much you care for the care of athletes. So if you're, you know, those of you that listen to this wanting all the information on going into surgery, that's great, but consider being an athletic trainer as well, because it's a really, really rewarding position.
Very cool. I agree. So... All right, well, Dr. Geyer, you can either stay on and we'll close it out, or if you need to go, you can head out at this point.
Yeah, I probably need to take off, unfortunately, on call this entire week and this weekend. But I do want to say, Jeremy, and all of you, I really appreciate you guys letting me do this. I really enjoyed it. Any way I can help you guys in the future, definitely touch base.
All right, well, thank you very much, Dr. Geyer.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Oh, anytime. Thank you.
All right, so go ahead, Jocelyn.
We want to thank the people who helped make this broadcast possible. GHATS for sponsoring CEU opportunities, PISD Education Foundation, and Dr. David Geyer for the support of athletic training and his time today.
So we had to schedule it on Friday because, like I said, he was in surgery this morning. He came over to do the podcast, and he's on the call for surgery and anything else this weekend. So it's really cool to have an orthopedic surgeon come on and talk and really just about his life and some of his experiences and his expert opinion. So we're thankful for Dr. Geyer, and definitely check out his show again, Dr. David Geyer. It's Dr. David and then G-E-I-E-R, Dr. David Geyer. If you Google that, it'll probably come up even if you spell it wrong. So check him out. He's got a podcast he does just about every week. So that's pretty cool. And you can continue to listen to ours. Now, I do have a request. Is if you're listening to this, if you subscribe through iTunes, then to rate it through iTunes. So go to iTunes and write a review. You don't even have to write a review. Just rate it. And then that way it'll help people find it when they search for it. The more people that rate it, the more people that listen to it, the easier it is to find. So if you use iTunes at all, then please go to iTunes and rate it there. So... you can check out our website, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, where you can watch live almost every Wednesday on our website. You can join the conversation by following all the links there. You can follow us on Twitter, at PHS Sports Med, Sports Medicine Broadcast, on Google+, facebook.com/PHS Athletic Training. So for Jeremy,
George,
Marlon,
Jocelyn,
Marissa,
that's a wrap.